right, everyone. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. It's Wednesday, November 13th. A very, very cold morning here. A wicked cold morning. Like, I think it was like 10 degrees. I am driving in. I was absorbed listening to the testimony this morning before Congress regarding the impeachment. And as I said, I don't want to be on the air. I just want to listen. I am if I was afraid last night, after hearing Ambassador Taylor, I'm more afraid. I am really more afraid. And I said to him, I said to Ken, I said, you know, we refer to Donald Trump as Putin's puppet. And now I'm realizing he's Putin's clone, because every behavior is a behavior that Putin would exercise. And it's exactly what Donald Trump did. The threats, like, you know, it's not a quid pro quo. It's oh, my God. And the other thing is, I feel so bad for Zelensky. I feel so bad. New, young, no political history, kind of rode this wave of anger and, you know, let's clean the corruption out, did all these remarkable things as Ambassador Taylor was talking about. He was so hopeful. And then our corrupt president asked him to be a handmaiden to his corruption. Here he is trying to clean corruption up in the Ukraine. And what are we doing? We're having our president say, no, I'm going to shake you down so you can assist me in corruption. Oh, my God, how vile and disgusting. It's only vile and disgusting, and we've got elected a president. I can't wait to hear what the Republicans do to try to undermine what Ambassador Taylor said. I know they want to do it. I know they relish it. I want to know what the hell they're going to say. So anyway, everyone, I'm sorry. I am obviously emoting like crazy. Go on, Ken.
In case you can't tell, Arnie is really
I love my country. I love my country. I want people to figure out how to talk to each other. Yeah. But we have such an evil, evil, egotistical man with no sense of right and wrong. It is just shocking. And Ambassador Taylor, you know what else I said to Ken? I wish my children would grow up to be a man like him.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, so smart.
Integrity.
And so,
he loves his country. He wants to do the right thing.
And,
I mean, how about that as a value to underlie American policies is do the right thing.
And so committed to Ukraine.
It doesn't seem so foreign.
I know.
The right thing is what I thought America was all about.
It is absolutely unbelievable, and I know that people on Fox won't be hearing it, and I know they're going to tune out. But I almost think that if they love their children, they have an obligation to tune in. They just need to. We have to have a sense of generational ethics, everyone. We must find that. And today's testimony is really about understanding that sense of the future, and we can't ignore it.
Right. Right. So give a brief Ken perspective, Ken with the rosy-colored glasses and finding hope in this tragedy that we're listening to. And the hope is, for me anyway, that it's a good sign for our country that the truth is coming out, that people like Bill Taylor and Kent and Fiona Hill and all the others Vildman are coming forward.
Yes.
And, you know, I was saying to Arnie at the beginning.
Courage.
Yeah, this guy, Bill Taylor, you know, he's a Republican. He served in the State Department for George W. Bush. He left during the Obama years. He's called back by Pompeo. But he's there, whatever party he belongs to, whatever policies he supports, he's there because he's an American patriot. He wants the best for this country.
And even says to Pompeo, I will not come back if we have changed our position on Ukraine. And Pompeo says, oh, no, we haven't. Oh, no, we haven't. Oh, yes, we have.
And Pompeo says, I'll back you up. That was Taylor's insistence. The other thing I found interesting, by the way, about Taylor's testimony was laying out the history before this, because we're all
important.
Focusing on, you know,
exactly.
2 or 3 months of this summer. But he laid it out going back to 2013 when the Russians had their own puppet president of Ukraine who was corrupt as can be. And finally, the Ukrainian people kicked him out and he flees to Russia, that president.
I know.
You know, that shows you where his loyalties are.
And
more moderates are elected, and this guy Zelensky, as Arnie was saying, you know, he came in, he rode in on an anti-corruption platform, but he was doing it much faster than he had even promised to do. And people, the populace in Ukraine, were thrilled to finally be on the track of being a democracy and you know, looking to the West and not being dominated by totalitarian Russia. And he laid out the history of several years, which is going back to, I think, 2013 or 14, when the Russians invaded Crimea and took it over. And it's chilling to listen to his story about just the Ukraine, because the Russians went in there and had this referendum where they held guns to the heads of the voters and said, do you want Russia to take over? And all the voters with the guns to their heads said, no, I think they said yes with the guns pointed to their heads.
Oh, all right.
You know, you vote yes, you die. So that was the Russians' bogus pretext for going in there. And then he also elaborated on the 4 years since where the Russian army is on the border, the eastern border of Ukraine, and they're killing Ukrainians.
Right.
And they're just shooting across the border, and they've killed thousands of people in Ukraine. So just this little chink in America's support, even just the optics of America may not support Ukraine, and we've canceled this aid. Who knows? Somebody like Putin, a megalomaniac like Putin, could easily see it as an opening and, we won't leave on the other side of the border.
And that's what Taylor said.
Exactly.
And let me just – we have to get to our guest, but let me just say one more thing. And that is, as I'm listening to this, also I want to remind everyone, Ambassador Taylor was concerned about Hunter Biden. He talked about Hunter Biden. He said it created the appearance of impropriety. He even said that. So I am so glad, because he is a level playing field.
Yeah.
Because he calls it as he sees it. This is not partisan. This is right or wrong. This is the appearance of impropriety. There is a difference between doing the right thing and doing something that sets you up to look like you're doing the wrong thing. I mean, I was so glad that it came out of his mouth.
Yeah.
Because, you know, I've been saying it. You've been saying it. But,
yeah.
But it's... It you know, the fact is, yes, it was legal, but it was wrong. Let me just say that.
And we discussed this on this show a number of times about how it's not just the appearance of impropriety, but even just thinking about it. Look, think about it. You teach your kids to know the difference between right and wrong.
Right.
Here's this guy who gets an offer of $50,000 a month to sit on the
with
board.
No area of expertise in this arena.
The only thing he has going for him is his father's name is Biden.
Exactly.
And you don't have to be a genius. You don't even have to be over 10 years old to know that that's wrong.
All right. So we're not going to be talking impeachment for the rest of the hour. But that's, you know what? Tomorrow, we're going to have so much of it. Between Russ Muirhead, the head of the government department at Dartmouth College, and Stefan Schmidt, you'll be in impeachment heaven. But before
So I'm glad we both got this off our chest
today,
because
we are apoplectic. So I'm going to read you what I posted last night. I sent it to Ken and a couple of other folks that are up here on this show. And this is what I put on Facebook last night, but what I want to read to you now before we grab our first guest. On the eve of the Trump public impeachment hearing, I searched out what I had posted on the eve of the 2016 election. I need to repost it now because all my fears have been realized. And like Bill Moyers, I am even more afraid. This is what I wrote everyone in 2016, the night before the election. I am afraid. I have never dreaded an upcoming election, but I dread tomorrow. I fear for my children, my state, my nation, my world. We have set our democracy up to fail. We have drowned it in mountains of secret cash. We have destroyed the Fourth Estate. We have aided and abetted collective ignorance. We have ignored growing inequality. There will not be a result on Tuesday. After listening to today, I am more than convinced. Trump wins, even if he loses. He will declare the election illegitimate, no matter the size of a Clinton victory. And if Trump wins, the angry electorate, having just participated in the 2016 electoral Rorschach test, will demand their pound of flesh. But every Trump voter has a different demand, and chaos and resentment is guaranteed. Back in the late 1980s, I read a book by the great educator Jonathan Kozol. A quote that he used to begin his book, Illiterate America, has never seemed so prescient as it does now. It was delivered by the British physicist and author C.P. Snow. Here is the quote, everyone. I can't help thinking of the Venetian Republic in their last half century. Like us, let me just grab my guest so my guest is here. I'll continue. I can't help thinking of the Venetian Republic in their last half century. Like us, the Venetians had once been fabulously lucky. They had become rich, as we did. They had acquired immense political skill, just as we have. A good many of them were tough-minded, realistic, patriotic men. They knew, just as clearly as we know, that the current of history had begun to flow against them. Many of them gave their minds to work working out ways to keep going. It would have meant breaking the patterns into which they had crystallized. They were so fond of the pattern, just as we are fond of ours. They never found the will to break it. Close quote. Then I ended my post from the day before the 2016 election. So much at risk, so few options. That, I mean, it's just unbelievable what I wrote the night before the election, and that's all I kept thinking about the night before, last night before the impeachment hearings began.
And let me just say that that is a beautiful piece of writing, Arnie.
Oh, my God.
Tears to my eyes.
Well, it was frightening. And I so apologize to my guests. This is such an emotional morning. But we know that we're going to be airing our show during the impeachment hearings, and we needed to talk about something other than impeachment. And as my audience has come to expect, where do I turn for interesting information and fabulous content? But I go to theconversation.com, which has turned out to be one of the best assets I have ever found. And I'm so glad that our next guest wrote for The Conversation, because the information that he shared is something that I think is so important, because as we move forward with the 2020 election, there are a lot of things we must address. And one of those things is obviously racism, a lack of revenue, how we police in America. And we are joined right now by Arizona professor Akhil Singla. If I mispronounce your name, please clear it up for me. And I entitled it A Search for Revenue. Cities with more black residents rely more on traffic tickets and fines for revenue. So welcome to the program.
Hi, Arnie. Thanks for having me.
And please, now, give me your name just as you pronounce it, not the way I hope I didn't butcher it.
No, you didn't. It's Akhil Singla.
Singla,
and I'm at
perfect.
Arizona State.
Okay,
yeah.
Fantastic. And you are a professor of public affairs at the Watts College of Public Service and Community Solutions, and your research focuses on public financial management at the state and local level with a specific focus on municipal debt, and you've explored municipal bankruptcy and things like that. All right, so you wrote your piece, and I love the way you started, because give everyone they can't see you. I did see a picture of you. But you start with the story of being stopped by a cop at age 22. And, you know, back then you thought, okay, I'll pay the fine. But then as you began to do more research later on in life, you began to sort of connect some dots. So why don't you share with my audience a little bit about how you begin your piece, because I think it helps to inform the rest of your article.
Yeah, so as you said, the backdrop for all of this ends up being a study where we look at traffic tickets and revenue and the racial component of that.
Yes.
But my personal story with all of this goes a lot further back, as you mentioned. So when I was 22, I was in grad school at Ohio State, and I was I drove out to a friend's wedding in Buffalo, and then I came back the next day. Because I had to get back to classes and stuff. I was speeding. Like, I was absolutely guilty of violating, the traffic laws. And so I was pulled over, and, I didn't really think much about it at the time. I was pulled over. I was speeding, and that's what happens sometimes. You got caught. And so I paid the ticket, and honestly, my primary concern is, I was still on my dad's car insurance. What is he going to think?
Right, when his car insurance rates go up.
And as time progressed, I started thinking about that interaction more. And to be clear, I don't have any reason to believe that there was nefarious motives on the part of this officer. But as I've learned more about how society functions and policing and the role of race in policing, and I'm an Indian American, so my skin is brown,
right.
And I was in rural Ohio when I was pulled over, and I have no reason to believe that was a reason why I was pulled over, but there is a large body of evidence that demonstrates that people of color tend to be pulled over more frequently. And so, that became something that I thought about more and more over time, and then Ferguson happened.
Right.
So Michael Brown was shot, and the Department of Justice started investigating, and basically they found this horrendous relationship between law enforcement, a majority African-American community, and the police force that was basically just trying to extract revenue.
Mm-hmm. And it's like it's policing for profit, I think, is what you refer to it as. So let me just say something. So this is, I think, the other thing. And we always look at like averages, but no city is an average. No town is an average. Right. And averages don't tell you anything. And you really need to start looking at where you see a significant change. If the average is 12%, but you see this community is at 20% for the purposes of revenues through traffic fines, you have to start asking yourself, so what is it about this community that's different from the average or the below average? And you went to California and you started looking to sort of compare and contrast. And I think this isn't surprising that you find that in certain places where there's a high percentage of people of color, there tends to be a higher percentage of revenue coming in through traffic fines, especially if the police force is predominantly white, yet the population may be predominantly black. And you have to start asking yourself, so what's the correlation here? And I think you began to notice that there really was a pattern.
Yeah. I mean, so, you know, not to get too into the weeds, but
you can.
I'm pretty confident in that result. It's this isn't just something, you know, in the conversation piece, I put up some relatively simple graphs showing a correlation, but the research is more complex, and so we use, you know, inferential statistics to try and basically figure out, is this pattern meaningfully different than sort of what we might see if this was happening randomly, if it just happened to be at that. And we can reject that idea that this is just randomly happening.
Right.
It really does appear that communities with larger African American populations are reliant more on revenue from traffic citations, and that appears to be exacerbated when law enforcement is much whiter than the community.
So, Akia, let me say something. You're talking to an old. I describe myself as a politician in recovery. And I come from a state that has no income tax or no sales tax. So we rely heavily on property taxes. I suspect we also rely heavily on traffic fines. I'm always saying we probably do, because I see it as a revenue device. And of course, we're a white state, but we have no tax base. Okay. We have no, so we always are looking for something. So what I would love to see is that as we were doing these stoppings for revenue, I wonder if anyone has ever color coded it. It would be really fascinating, because we're also a very big tourism state, and I'm sure a lot of people come here, and I don't think anyone has done it, but I challenge someone at the Carsey Institute to do it, because I would love to see who we tap for revenue, but I know that traffic fines are probably important. One of the things that gets me so depressed about your article, because you did see a correlation, were two things. In a community that was either predominantly black or had a significant African-American or population of color, and their police force was predominantly white, one of the things I really worry about is that they're not policing for profit. They're policing to pay their income, in the sense that they may have a low municipal tax rate, or they may not be able to produce the revenue, but they need police. So in a lot of ways, police are being asked to basically fund themselves. And the way you fund yourself is you look for the sort of easy target. And the easy target is going to be a traffic fine. And the easiest target is going to be a traffic fine on a person of color, because they probably don't – they aren't on the city council. They don't represent the big, you know, property owners and whatever. So in a bizarre way, by not adequately funding state government and municipal government, you're setting police up to fail, because they are looking for a way to make sure that they get a paycheck. And so they're going to go the easiest route that will create the less – it'll be less suspect perhaps.
Yeah, I think that you bring up some really good points. I mean, so the theory behind all of this is basically, so why would a police force target either explicitly or, you know, just implicitly minority communities?
Right.
And it tends to be a lack of representation politically.
Yes.
And not in my research, but there's other research that shows this relationship between fines fines as a revenue source. And race is reduced when there's more black representation on city councils.
Depressing, you know. It's like, you sort of think it, but then when you can begin to see that there's actually empirical data to support it, you get even more depressed.
Can I just add one thing to your explanation, Akhil? I know you know this, but the listeners might not. in trying to analyze whether the pattern that we see is the kind of thing that you'd normally expect, there are other explaining factors that might explain why the pattern is what you see, but you account for that in your methodology. You hold all those things equal. All of the things being equal, cities with a higher black population are more likely to rely on traffic tickets. Those exogenous variables are taken into account in the analysis. So those are not the explainer, and all you're left with is race. The thing you're
that appears to be the driving factor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we control for, or we include in our analysis, crime rates. We also include measures of financial health of the government.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And we don't see any relationship between those variables and reliance on fine. That any pattern that you observe there appears to be indistinguishable from random.
And yet you point out in your piece that policing for profit via civil asset forfeiture and traffic tickets is unfortunately a documented phenomenon that alters police behavior. This is that line, alters police behavior, is just jumped out at me. And it was from my perspective, just really, really frightening. And then you also point out that studies persistently find that minority residents, communities of color, are more common recipients of law enforcement action and punishment, you know, driving while black. We've heard that over and over again. And then you also talk about the idea of the representation. Talk to me a little bit about how we can solve this.
Yeah, so I mean, I think we've sort of talked around some of the ways. I think in how we've been talking about this, representation obviously matters, and then there are some financial incentives. And so, if I were put in a position to try and like solve these issues, those are the two things I would tackle. So the first thing that I would focus on is severing the financial incentive that an individual police officer, a law enforcement agency, a city councilor, whatever, would have to try and fine residents more. So basically, how that would happen in practice is, instead of saying that the revenues from traffic citations go back to the city that collects them, pool them at the state level and then distribute it back down to local government.
I love it.
Based on population or something like that.
Has anyone ever done that?
To my knowledge, no state does that. There are policy proposals out there to work on addressing that relationship.
Well, even to start, Akhil, what I would do is even to say, if not at the state level, at least at the county level. I mean, at least to expand the scope so that you mentioned it alters police behavior. Well, that's because they know that the fines are initiated at the city level, and then they're fined, and then it goes back into the city coffers. So they can actually see kind of a quid pro quo, but they actually see a cause and a cause and effect. But if you at least expand it so they go into a bigger pool of revenues, so you can't necessarily see that it enhances the revenue in your community, then it really does make a difference. Oh my God, I don't know. You should go before the state legislature or the council of state governments and like suggest this as model legislation, because I think this would be useful, because in the end, communities don't want to have people profiled. They don't want cops to profit by these kinds of fines. In the end, they really don't want that. And this is a way for them to say, at least our behaviors can be changed by doing this.
Can I ask you a question, Akhil, about that? How do you distribute the money from the state pool back to the towns? Because if you do that, then it does give an incentive to my city's police department. I get more money back for my town if I've sent more in, right?
If
it's proportional to that, or is it proportional to the amount of money you need, or your population, or something?
You could set it up so that you reduce the relationship. So you could basically say it's per capita. Right. So just distribute it however. You could earmark it for school funding if you wanted to. You could all sorts of other things that just reduce, because the problem is the individual officer and the individual law enforcement agency believing that they need to do this to benefit them directly.
Yes,
exactly. Any things that you can do to reduce that tie, reduce the incentive for the law enforcement agencies to find more.
That's why I asked the question, though, because to give it to education or to the
to
city's need is going to depend on, poor communities need more money for schools. So, I mean, that's how the New Hampshire distributes its property tax. We try to target the districts that are most in need rather than the ones that paid in more.
So, yeah, it's difficult to completely get rid of the incentives. But the thing is that right now we don't have any.
There are actually incentives in favor.
Yes.
Exactly.
Right? So the goal would be to reduce the incentives. Now, the other way to reduce the incentives is just stop using fines to punish any, as a part of the criminal justice system.
Okay.
Now, that's a much more expansive proposal that I think is beyond my expertise, because I think you start getting into issues of criminal justice and how the criminal justice system functions and how do we punish and deter behavior,
right,
and what's most effective. Are financial penalties relevant? Should they exist? I think that those are important conversations to have.
For another day.
If the goal is to get rid of this, toxic incentive, I think there are ways to, if not completely eliminate, reduce the problem.
And again, I also want to remind everyone, you also say elect more ethnic and racial minorities to be mayors or serve on city councils and proactively focus on ensuring meaningful representation in the unelected bureaucracy. Amen. Amen. This is so important. And I look at what you wrote about, and I go back to architecture. I'm not sure I have the quote correctly, but sort of function follows form. And what you're saying is we may not be able to, completely eliminate certain behaviors, but right now we're actually aiding and abetting those behaviors. And if we change the form, we might change some of the outcomes. And that's really what you're saying here by looking at pooling those fines, by looking at changing the ethnic makeup and the racial makeup of our city councils and our mayors. And all those things give a heightened sense of awareness, if nothing else. And at least if we have a heightened sense, we'll still have problems, but maybe not so many. So, and also, you know what it also says to me too, Akhil, is that I notice and I care. And I think a community needs to hear people in authority say, I notice, I want this to change, I don't want to set my cops up to fail, I don't want to create a system where they think they have to generate this profit in order to be either successful or pay their incomes or whatever it is. So let me create that disconnect. We still want the best police force, but we don't want the best police force because they're able to find more people. And then, of course, they find the people that ultimately set us all up to fail because it sort of enhances our sense of racism. Mm-hmm. So it's a great piece. Cities with more black residents rely more on traffic tickets and fines for revenue. He is a professor of public policy at Arizona State University. Akhil Singla, do me a favor, write some model legislation. I'd love to ship it around. Anyway, take care.
Thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, everyone. This is the beginning of those impeachment hearings. I'm very emotional today. It's The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and Ken Barnes. A little labor history is next.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two.
On this day in labor history, the year was 1974. That was the day Karen Silkwood was killed in a mysterious car crash. Though her death was ruled a one-car accident, some maintain she was forced off the road. Silkwood was a union activist and representative for Local 5-283 of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers. She worked at Kerr McGee's Cimarron Plutonium Plant in Crescent, Oklahoma, making plutonium pellets for nuclear reactor fuel rods. Meryl Streep popularized her life in the 1983 film Silkwood. Karen's union loyalty only grew after the company crushed a strike in 1972. She was elected to the Union Bargaining Committee just as the company moved to force a decertification election. She also served as a union health and safety rep. Silkwood found a number of apparent violations: routine contamination exposure, faulty respiratory equipment, falsified inspection reports, and improper storage of radioactive material. She met with OCAW leader Tony Mazzocchi to highlight safety issues in a campaign to beat back the decertification. It worked. Karen testified before the Atomic Energy Commission, worried about her own contamination. It was clear her home was contaminated too. She worked tirelessly to gather the documentation and the evidence detailing the company's life-threatening negligence. And on this day, Karen Silkwood was headed to Oklahoma City to meet Mazzocchi's assistant Steve Wodka and a New York Times reporter to present the evidence she collected. she never made it. Her car was found with rear-end damage near skid marks in a ditch along Route 74. While the company attempted to smear her as a drug-addicted lesbian who deliberately contaminated herself, they would eventually settle with her family for nearly $1.4 million. Karen Silkwood became a model and hero for women workers and all those who fight for safe workplaces.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Saving for retirement pays off. If you deposit money into an IRA, its earnings can grow over time, and so can your nest egg. James Finch is the Director of Finance for Brantford, Connecticut. He says as cities and towns focus on the costs of rising seas and more extreme weather, they can take a similar approach.
What if we started saving money? We'll start with $1 million, and what if we started adding to that every year? And then what if we were able to invest it at a rate that could compound so that it grows faster?
His town is doing just that through its new Coastal Resiliency Fund. Finch says Brantford put $1 million in to start, with more to be added each year. Over time, the invested funds are expected to grow. Then, when it comes time to repair a flooded bridge, elevate houses, or improve stormwater drainage, the town can tap into those funds.
This provides a vehicle for a community to put money aside and so it can grow for the long term, just like any family would for funding their kids' college or funding their retirement accounts.
Finch says that for towns and cities that can afford to, it makes sense to start saving now for the future costs of climate change. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. Learn more at yaleclimateconnections.org.
Hi there, folks. You know, these days it seems like more and more people are just out for themselves. I gotta tell you, maybe because the outlook for the future is so uncertain. People can turn on you and act like they never even knew you. Just put right under the bus. There really seems to be no loyalty today. It's like nothing I've ever seen before. Just take a look at these two-bit politicians, lost, scratching their heads in the kitchen. You'd think they were itching, fitting to throw us all under the bus.
Play the rest of that song. I'm sorry, it was only 3 minutes long. Dean won't be a happy camper. This is The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producer Ken Barnes. As you know, Ken picks our music. That is a great song. I think we're gonna have an event at the house on December 15th. I think I want to play that a couple of times though. All right, so who sings Throw Me Under the Bus?
Well, that is someone called Reed Man.
Wow, Reed Man. I want more.
You hear the
Reed
saxophone
Man
in the background.
I tell you, I'm in love. I'm in love. All right, so we have not talked to our next guest for a long time. But we love to – I think he's one of our favorite economists. So I saw an article at Salon.com by economist Dean Baker. It was entitled, A Bold Plan to Strengthen and Improve Social Security is What America Needs. The Social Security 2100 Act would both improve the program's benefit structure and its financial picture. This is Dean, who co-founded the Center for Economic and Policy Research. He is a senior economist there, and his area of research includes housing, macroeconomics, economics, intellectual property, and of course, Social Security and Medicare. So, welcome back to the program, Dean. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you doing, Ernie?
I'm doing great. You know, I'm thinking of Social Security a lot, and a couple of reasons why. One, I'm 66, so obviously I'm now. I definitely did qualify.
You're literally, picking it up.
Yeah, exactly. But I lost my husband at age 60. And you had to be married at least 10 years, and you had to be 60 in order to collect his Social Security. And I was married a little over 10 years to Marty before he died of cancer. And I turned 60 on October 1st, and he willed himself to live till October 31st. Mm-hmm. So in a way, his gift to me was his Social Security. And in part, it was because he knew he had a stable income and that his Social Security check was going to be significantly higher than mine because I was a liberal progressive former politician who was always fired. So it was just – so as I'm looking at this, but then I look at the size of the check I get – and I realized if it wasn't for a couple of people who ultimately ended up helping to take care of me, I would be really in poverty today. So let's talk about Social Security and how to fix it, because I think for a lot of people, it is a lifeline, and it's a lifeline right now that doesn't guarantee the kind of stability I think a lot of people thought it might.
Yeah, well, Social Security has been an enormously important program, as you and just about everyone else recognizes, and it's kept tens of millions of retirees, and I should also add in disabled people, out of poverty. Mm-hmm. But it's not a terribly generous benefit, and, you know, that's important for people to understand. So it's not sufficient to maintain a middle-class living standard. The idea always, you know, certainly when the program was started and through much of its existence, was that people would be able to supplement that with a pension from their workplace. And certainly, if you go back, you know, 30, 40 years, most middle-class retirees, and I can say the poor had it well, but middle-class retirees did have a pension from their workplace, and that together with Social Security would be sufficient to maintain a decent standard of living in retirement. Now, what's happened over the last, say, 30 years is we've been seeing defined benefit traditional pensions disappear. People now have 401ks, IRAs, but we have data on that. Those don't come close to replacing the traditional pensions that are disappearing. So what that means is, as much as we might like to shore up that system, and I think that's great, I've worked with efforts on that, most people are looking at a retirement where Social Security is going to be the bulk of their income. And what that means is we should be looking to make it more generous. And that's what this bill does. It's not huge that way. I don't want to say, you know, everyone's getting but it is a step in the right direction. So it increases that.
Yes, as I'm thinking about this, one of the things I keep hearing about, though, is that so you're talking about sort of increasing to some extent what people are able to obtain from their Social Security, and you talk about the fact that people used to have defined pension plans. So there's a couple of things I keep thinking about. One, the aging demographic. So we are seeing a huge jump in the number of people that are going to now be qualified for Social Security. We're seeing not a significant pipeline of young people. So the number of people that are working that need to support people on Social Security, that number is changing. We're also seeing this grotesque inequality. So that means if they're, you know, we're almost losing that middle class, which is where you got the heft in your Social Security check. So if people are only making up to $50,000, but yet you collect Social Security up to $133,000, but people seem to not be able to get quite to that place because it's all being sucked up to people at the very top, you're actually not seeing the amount of dollars going into the Social Security Trust Fund. And then the other thing that you mentioned about the defined pension plan, it's not only that people don't have a defined pension plan, but even if they had a 401k or some other kind of reserve, they don't have job stability. So you don't have one job for 30 years or 40 years. I mean, I can tell you myself and a lot of other people I know have 5, 6, or 7 jobs, and that doesn't create the ability or the stability to be able to put money aside, let alone have a defined pension plan. So there's so many ifs right now in this economy as we're moving forward that the idea isn't only to stabilize the fund and obviously increase it, but we need more revenue because so much has changed over the course of the last 30 years.
Yeah, so there's a few things there. I mean, one is the demographics. We are seeing a rising ratio of retirees to workers. You have a lot of people who've been highlighting that in Washington for decades and saying, oh, my God, we have to cut Social Security. Now, the reality is we've always had a rising ratio of retirees to workers. It's going to happen a little more rapidly over the next few years because with the baby boom cohort retiring, many of them already are. You're a baby boomer. I'm a baby boomer. You know, I'm semi-retired now. So, I mean, we're already seeing that, and that will be a strain, but that's not qualitatively different than what we've seen in the past. I mean, if you go back to 1960, there were 5 workers for every retiree. Currently, we're at something like 2.8, and we're projected to get to around 2 in about 15 years. So we've already seen a big fall in that. So that by itself isn't a big problem. Now, the other point you're mentioning about inequality, that is a huge problem. It's a huge problem for two reasons. One is just, you know, the straight arithmetic of the program is more money has gone to those at the top. That we have a cap. You aren't taxed on wages above roughly $133,000. I mentioned that in the piece.
Right.
So as more money goes to people, a larger share of, I should say, the wage bill goes to people at the very high end, more escapes taxation. So if we go back 40 years, only 10% of wages escape taxation. Now it's about 18%. So that's made the program less, less flush than otherwise would have been. The other reason why that's an issue is what we've done historically, dealing with this issue of increasing the number of retirees for each worker is we have raised the tax. So we've increased the tax. You go back to the when it was first created, it was about 3%. I'd have to double check the exact number. It's now 12.4%. That's taking both worker and employee contributions. So we had large increases in the tax rate in the 50s and the 60s and the 70s, even in the 80s. For the most part, that wasn't a really big deal because wages were rising.
Right.
So that's not a really bad story. But if you have a story where wages are not rising, which has been largely the case over the last four decades, then telling people, oh, we're going to raise your Social Security tax, that doesn't sound very good. Mm-hmm. So inequality is really front and center in this story.
Yeah, absolutely. So this bill has about 200 co-sponsors. Tell me about sort of the basic framework of the bill. And while it is not obviously nirvana, it does move us in a better direction.
Yeah, so in terms of increasing benefits, the two main things are, first off, it establishes a basic benefit if you've worked 30 years, you're guaranteed a benefit that's at least 125% of the poverty level.
Wow.
So the logic there is if you spent your life working, and presumably, if you know, many people in low-wage jobs, part-time jobs, so but if you contributed to the Social Security Fund for 30 years, you'll get a benefit that's at least 125% of the poverty level. That's not great, but...
Now, what is that in dollars? What does that mean today?
That would come to, for a single individual,
yeah,
it's roughly $12,000 a
okay.
year. I'd
okay.
have to double-check that, but
okay.
that's a ballpark number.
Mm-hmm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's not great, you know, but that's better than what a lot of people are looking at. A lot of people are looking
but,
at considerably
But it's closer
less.
To 20 for a family of four, although if you're
No,
retired,
I meant a single individual.
He meant a single individual.
No, I know.
But
if you have a spouse, it's more than that.
Right.
Yeah, so
right.
And it's 25% above the poverty level.
Okay.
So, and the other thing it does in terms of increasing benefits is increases benefits roughly $400 a year. So, you know, that's pretty
that's
much
not much either.
No, it's not a huge amount, but that will help a lot of people. So that's what it does by way of increasing benefits. Then the program is projected to face a shortfall, so there's two ways to address that. One, a very gradual increase in the payroll tax, a tenth of a percentage point a year for 24 years. So that's
mm-hmm.
split between the worker and the employee, so five hundredths of a percentage point.
Mm-hmm.
And then the other thing it does is it imposes the tax on workers who earn more than $400,000 a year. So I mentioned earlier that it was capped at $133,000. What this would do is it's still the cap, but then it says, okay, if you're a really high-end earner, you're earning $500,000-$700,000,
mm-hmm.
you're going to pay the tax on income above $400,000. Now, that's a little strange the way that's set up, and
yeah,
personally not how I would do it.
What was the rationale of the bill sponsor to do this? Number one, to have that little bubble in the center. Number two, when you are providing people with a tax on over $400,000, is it divided between the employer and the employee or just the employee?
It would be on both.
It would be on both. Okay.
So the rationale was basically it wanted to you have upper middle income people, you know, so you roughly 7%, maybe 7.5% of the workforce is now above that cap. So let's say someone earning $135,000, $140,000,
okay.
so they're just a little above the cap. That a lot of people fall into that area. I think they were trying to avoid putting a tax increase on these people just because, you know, a lot, I'll be honest, I haven't consulted with them, but a lot of them are people who contribute to political campaigns.
I was just thinking that's right. They cut checks. All right, keep going.
They don't want to piss them off.
Yeah.
On the other hand, if you just say above 400,000, that's, you know, roughly 1% of the population.
Yeah.
And, you know, they probably figured, okay, one, these people certainly could afford it. And two, better or worse, there aren't that many of them, so they don't, you know,
mm-hmm.
they could still lose some campaign contributions, but I guess they're prepared to live with that.
Well, you know, what really bothers me is that wealthy people don't have income. They don't pay income. They have all this other money that flows into their what they call wealth, but it's not like you and I with a paycheck. And that's sort of somewhat problematic too, because they're multi billionaires, but they escape anything in the way of this kind of revenue. Even if you did over $400,000, because they don't have a wage. They don't have a paycheck. Is there a way? Has anyone ever come up with a way of helping to fund Social Security? But I know Elizabeth Warren and her wealth tax, but we're using it for 1,000 different reasons. But maybe could we, like, I don't know, attach it to a capital gains tax or something like that? Because, again, that is where most of the very, very wealthy actually earn their living. It isn't through a paycheck.
No, it's true, and there have been various proposals. I know in particular some people have proposed committing the estate tax, so raise the estate tax and commit that to Social Security.
That's interesting.
I'll just mention the counter-argument. Social Security historically was set up as workers paying for their own retirement, and certainly when Roosevelt introduced it, this is our money.
Okay.
And when you start to move away from that, then I think, and I'm not arguing necessarily that this is correct, but I think the concern is real that people would see it as a welfare program.
Well, let me just stop you here. Are hedge fund managers workers?
Well, insofar as they get paid wages,
I know.
Supposed to pay taxes on that. I'm the last person on earth to defend hedge fund managers.
I know.
But I'm just saying the way their income is calculated, they will have some that will be calculated as wages, and at least in principle, they should be paying the tax on that.
Right.
Then they also have this game where they have a lot that gets classified as carried interest, which they pay a very low tax rate on. They pay no Social Security tax on that. That's a total scam. But in principle, they are workers and they are paying Social Security tax on what's classified as wages.
Well, I mean, that's why I would love people to take a look at what a CEO earns. And it's what they earn is what's called a compensation package. it's not called a wage, And you talked about, workers taking care of themselves. Well, CEOs are workers, but they have managed to create a payment structure that avoids a lot of the things that the little people have to do. And I think that's somewhat problematic, too, because if this really is going to be workers taking care of themselves, then maybe what we should do is not call it based on wages. Maybe we should call it based on a compensation package. And that's another reason why, for example, I would love Medicare for All. Because if you called it a compensation package, and you could say to all those, labor unions that have gotten those great, benefit packages for their health insurance, well, we'll call it a compensation package, and you could pay a tax on it. They'd kill me. And I'd say, well, there's Medicare for All. You could look at that as an option. And then you don't have to worry about it as a compensation package. I almost think people need to we have to rewrite the terms of art, because only certain people get wages and other people who are affluent do not.
Can I just say, what about people who you're talking about, CEOs who at least have companies there, but what about people that are just clipping coupons? The Rockefellers have plenty of wealth that they inherited, or Donald Trump for that matter. And, the Rockefellers don't necessarily have to be a CEO of anything in order to earn a heck of a lot more money than you and I do.
But I think a coupon clipper isn't a worker, and I think a CEO is a worker.
No,
anyway, Dean.
Don't they get Social Security?
Of course.
Well, if they've never worked, they don't. I think most of them probably at least have something that they've passed off as work.
That's right. So I'm just kind of curious, because again, that's part of the problem is that terms of art are sort of old fashioned when you're looking at the way people actually earn a living.
Yeah, well, that often gets to be a problem, and it's actually unfortunately at the other end as well. So Uber drivers, if you ask Uber, they're not workers; they're independent contractors.
Exactly.
And so there is a lot to this in the sense that what you call people does make a big difference. And of course, calling them independent contractors rather than workers means they don't have the right to unionize, they don't get unemployment benefits, they aren't guaranteed the minimum wage, they don't get disability. So it really does matter, and unfortunately this is a world where we end up playing games. Are you a worker? No, I'm an independent contractor. I mean, that's I just say it's unfortunate we get into that sort of story.
All right, yesterday the Supreme Court heard the case on DACA. And what we know about this administration is how anti-immigrant this administration is. And, of course, they throw everything at the undocumented immigrants, of which there are approximately maybe 12 million, if not more, in the United States. And we're talking about Social Security. My understanding is that a number of undocumented immigrants actually pay into the Social Security Trust Fund. And if those undocumented immigrants were suddenly sent home, wherever home is, that the Social Security Trust Fund would tank, because, in fact, they are paying so much. They're not receiving benefits, but they are paying into it. And I think people don't quite understand that Social Security, to a large extent, is also being kept afloat, not only by the young worker bees, but by the young undocumented immigrant bees. And I think that's a number that nobody ever really talks about. But I think it's really important, as we look at Social Security, how much undocumented immigrants actually contribute.
Yeah, no, it is a big deal. It's several billion dollars a year. I don't have the number at my fingertips, but most undocumented workers, they are paying Social Security taxes, and exactly as you say, they won't get benefits. I mean, that may subsequently change, at least many of us hope it will, before they hit retirement age. But as it stands now, if you're undocumented and you're paying your Social Security taxes, you'll never see anything for that.
And how do we let people know that? Because, again, what they do is they see an undocumented immigrant as someone who's just a drain on the system. And I think it's really important because I think we would have to fix Social Security much faster if those people were basically – if Donald Trump's vision of America would happen overnight. I don't think we understand what the collapse would be to the economy, let alone what would happen in the agricultural area, what would happen in the meatpacking area, but also what would happen to the Social Security Trust Fund. I mean, if they're going to be talking about this, I think we have to give people an idea of where the money is coming from right now that's actually funding that fund. And it turns out that it's a significant contribution from undocumented immigrants.
Yeah, there have been a number of studies that have looked at the net, you know, just looking at what they pay in taxes versus what they get out in benefits. And at least all the ones I've seen shows that they pay well more in taxes than what they get in benefits. Now, I'll just qualify that a little bit in that you have, if you look at some areas that have a large number of undocumented, you know, say a specific community, that area may be paying out more in benefits, say public schools, the kids are going to school and other benefits, then that area is getting in tax revenue.
So
you have undocumented people there. They may not be paying that much by way of property tax. Their kids are going to school. So that area is actually being hurt. But if you take government as a whole, then, you know, again, every study I've seen finds that undocumented workers pay much more in taxes than what they get back in benefits.
So is this a bipartisan effort or is this exclusively a Democratic effort? Because, you know, I mean, I look at all the red states that voted for Donald Trump and you're looking at, you know, life expectancy going down. You're looking at some significant aspects of poverty. You're looking at the fact that most of them used to have manufacturing jobs and do not. So the idea of relying on Social Security is crucial for them. Are we able to get some sort of bipartisan support for this? Is there any hope that this would happen, or would it really require not only new leadership at the top, but Democratic majorities in both the House and Senate?
Well, that's a very, very good question. Republicans don't want to be seen opposed to Social Security.
Exactly.
Five years ago, 14 years ago, when President Bush wanted to privatize Social Security, they never even got a bill introduced in Congress. That was even though they controlled both houses at that time. And that was because they did not want to be seen as opposing Social Security. So I don't think it's altogether impossible. I mean, as long as Trump's in the White House, I have to say it's hard to envision, but I think not impossible that you could get momentum on this. And that's why it's important. There's over 200 co-sponsors. I don't know the exact number, so it's almost a majority in the House. So if you actually got the bill passed in the House, I could imagine the Democrats really pushing on this. And they know, you know, older people vote, and it's obviously not just people, you know, already Social Security age, but people in their 50s, they know at one point, or at least they hope they're going to be in their 60s and collecting Social Security.
Exactly.
I don't think it's an impossibility. You know, it's not the most likely story, but it's certainly not impossible.
So Dean Baker is an economist. The title of his piece at Salon.com, A Bold Plan to Strengthen and Improve Social Security is What America Needs. Now you have to pay attention to Social Security. The 2100 Act, or however they pronounce it, in Congress would both improve the program's benefit structure and its financial picture. And I have one quick question. Andrew Yang, I just got to ask, is his idea of a guaranteed income a good idea or a bad idea?
Yes
or no? I'll give you one.
No, I mean, we have a lot of programs like Medicare, Medicaid. I mean, it really depends what you coupled it with. So should everyone get a guaranteed income? That would be wonderful, but it depends a lot on what the rest of that story is.
All right. Okay, thank you. I had to ask the question because it sounds so attractive, but it just doesn't feel so real. And I'm the kind of person that says, you know, give me Medicare for all before you give me $1,000 a month. And if nothing else, I won't have to be worried about losing a job and then losing my access to health care. And I won't have to worry about paying COBRA. Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, that's my priority.
Yeah,
let's make sure people have health care. If we could figure out a way where we're still going to be able to fund this, sure, I'll have that conversation.
All right, I love you.
I love you.
Okay, take care, Dean Baker. I really appreciate it.
Okay, you too. Thanks a lot for having me on.
Bye-bye. Anyway, I had to ask that question because that's why Medicare for All is better than the $1,000. I'm sorry, people. Just from peace of mind, you know, I mean, think about that. You lose your job and then all of a sudden the fear is, can I afford COBRA? Can I go to a doctor?
Right. Well, his point is, his answer to that was really good. That it depends on basically the entire system because it all works in tandem.
Exactly. It's a quilt.
And also, you know, $1,000 a month is not going to, it's below the poverty line.
I know. All right, everyone. We're going to end with.
We're going to end with Prince and the Revolution singing When Doves Cry, because you and I listening to that testimony today, everybody in America listening to it, everybody's got to be crying.
Right. It was a collective emotional moment. Here we go, everyone.